Fremantle Press podcast is recorded in Wallilup on Noongar Whadjuk Boodja, and we offer our respects to Noongar elders past, present and emerging. Welcome to the Fremantle Press podcast, Fogarty Literary Awards special edition. My name's Georgia Richter, publisher and judge of the Fogarty, along with publisher Kate Sutherland and author Brooke Donnell. We're here to introduce the Fogarty Literary Awards shortlist. In a moment, 2021 Fogarty Literary Award winner Brooke Donnell, who's author of The Glasshouse, will interview Patrick Marlborough about their manuscript, Knock Loose. But first, I'd like to tell you a bit about why I love their work. Patrick Marlborough is a writer, comedian, journalist, critic and musician based in Wallilup, Fremantle and Whadjuk Boodja. They've been published in many national and international publications, and their novel, A Horse Held at Gunpoint, was shortlisted in the 2021 Fogarty Literary Award. Their novel, Knock Loose, begins with a tragic fire that rips through the southwest town of Bodkin's Point. But this tragedy is really just a way of unleashing the hounds of mayhem in a town that, since it was established, has featured every year a bloody medieval festival in which participants may or may not lose their dignity, body parts, or even their lives. One of the central characters of this novel is Joy, and she has lost her granddaughter in the fire. Joy's a former champion archer and stunt woman, and so she's really equipped to wreak vengeance on her own. I absolutely love Patrick's novel for its comic timing, its anime stylings, its cartoon violence, and the way that it made me laugh out loud. The thing is, I reckon you can only write about mayhem if you do it with control. And Patrick is very much in control of their material. Let's hear Brooke Donnell talking with Patrick Marlborough.
So, Patrick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to see you. We're here today to talk about your manuscript, Knock Loose. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about the story?
Knock Loose is about a retired former Olympic archer and gold medalist and stunt woman whose granddaughter is killed in a bushfire that she slowly works out was arson. And she goes on a bloody quest of revenge. But it is set within a small country town that every year for the last 120 or so years has thrown a militantly insane medieval reenactment festival that has its own lore, meta history and meta fiction that is incredibly intense and silly.
Anything else to say about it? Because, yeah, there's so much to it.
There's a lot of elements. When I first started to write it, I had the idea about 5 years ago when I went to Bowing Out Medieval Festival to write about it for Vice. And I took a lot of photos there. And I particularly love these photos I have of like Bogan BMX, like Mongoose BMX shirt guys smoking diaries and wearing speed heels, but dressed in full knight armor. And like, and something about that image just really stuck in my head. And I watched the melees of like these little kids really going at it. And it was a very misty, muddy day. So it actually looked very gothic and like kind of over the top. That story came to combine with this revenge thriller one really only when I started writing the book, which was not very long ago. Basically, I wanted to write a script for a revenge thriller starring Magda Sabansky, like a Charles Bronson Death Wish type movie. And I was like, I'm going to write a revenge movie, but with Magda Sabansky in the lead, like a John Wick type film. And I had the image of like these knights on the back of a ute firing flaming arrows into the bush. And that's about all I had in my head for about 5 years. And then when I started writing, it really just spilled out of me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when you read the extract next that readers will be able to picture the Magda Sabansky character and those kind of like, the guys with the arrows, like you've said, I think that really comes to life.
Yeah, sure. This is from one of the early chapters. It's kind of the first part that really starts to get into detail about Asian Court, which is the festival they put on every year, mm-hmm. where I think the reader suddenly realizes that maybe it's a bit bigger in scope and a bit more intense than the kind of allusions to it so far have suggested. And it's about how the protagonist, Joy, first picked up a bow and arrow because she was a child bow and arrow prodigy, and her deadbeat alcoholic cult-mannered father, who was a car thief, was also the festival's most beloved bandit. So it's kind of an introduction to that, essentially.
Great.
Joy had first picked up a bow at age 6 at Asian Court in 1964, then the 95th consecutive Asian Court to date. Asian Court was Bodkin's Point's pride. It's everything. The Begun in 1869, a year after the town settlement, Agincourt was conceived, hosted, funded, and fought in by the town's wealthy, quasi-mythic Captain Bodkin, the first of his name. The captain claimed his own ancestors had fought and died gallantly at the Agincourt of legend, and that the blood of great knights ran through his veins. What you could generously call an eccentric, Captain Bodkin spent a small fortune on the festival, then more of a tournament, each year shipping antique armor and weaponry from around the world to the little town he built in the bush, on the back of its timber, tin, and apples, all of which he owned the majority stake in. At the first reenactment, he armed the town's men and boys, divided them into French and English armies, and had them go at it on Bodkin Hill, a large slope ending in a flat at the back of his quickly growing estate. A soldier and a policeman before he was a land baron, Captain Bodkin drilled the town as if he were an exiled king raising a rebel army, training the timber workers, shearers, tinsmiths, pub owners, apple farmers, and drunks in the art of chivalry and swordsmanship, bestowing titles, sigils, and heraldry on the larger families, and knighting men who pronounced Agincourt with a hard G, as if he'd hoped they'd pass the mispronunciation down their line for as long as the town stood. The townsfolk met this good-humouredly at first, indulging the famous captain's whims and thuggish fancies, under the mistaken belief that this was a one-off carnival of fun held to ring in the town's first year officially on the map. But good humour turned to intergenerational fumes where Captain Bodkin insisted they fight with intent to kill. Just intent, mind you, nothing rougher than the drunken footy matches they played against the neighbouring towns. A touch of maiming or crippling here and there, the odd death being an unfortunate, if not unforeseen, consequence. The inaugural Agincourt left 5 dead and 3 seriously wounded, with the town's doctor losing a hand and having his ability to mend the busted and broken severely inhibited. But news of the then weekender spread to neighbouring towns, through Bridgetown and Donnybrook and Busselton, until the fable snaked its way up to Perth to become talk of the city, a punchline and a curiosity in a place that was determinedly incurious. The ranks of the French and English armies swelled over the following years, and Captain Bodkin, who they'd crowned the Captain King, would wade into the muddy melee on the back of his aging warhorse, swinging his sabre at big city lawyers, accountants, newspapermen, engineers, dock workers, shipwrights, bums, journalists, and rubberneckers, or charging them with his homemade eucalypt lance, to which he'd attached his army bayonet. The money from the events swelled the town's coffers, and Bodkin's point seemed shielded from the economics ups and downs that buffeted neighboring towns throughout the years, thanks to the interest in their wholly unique tradition and the madman who helmed it.
Thank you. That was really good. And that's a really good backstory for what's going to happen in this, the Agincourt that is the subject of the manuscript. Your novel combines some really big human emotions like grief and that revenge story you were talking about before, the Magda Zabansky revenge story. But there's also these really hilarious slapstick scenes going on. So I was wondering, how did the anime that's also in the manuscript, if we haven't mentioned that yet, but also your sense of what makes good comedy, how did those things kind of influence the way you balance those elements in the book?
Since about the age of like 12, I've had this deep desire to combine Looney Tunes, Bugs Bunny with like James Joyce. That's kind of been what I've been working towards as a writer my entire life. Mm-hmm. This book is pretty close. I find it funny, like, yeah, my last book that got shortlisted was also kind of about a suicide and people's grief around that to a degree, but was a slapstick screwball comedy, essentially. And I find that kind of grief, almost as a mechanic, a very good way to actually, like, hang jokes and scenarios as baubles on. I think when I started writing this, like I said, my original intention was a lot more focused and a lot more grounded. I thought it was going to be like a realistic revenge thriller to a degree. And the Agincourt stuff almost came out of nowhere and just like swelled exponentially, and all the little details and all the characters. And as it got sillier and sillier, I kind of liked that side of it more and more. And to me, like as someone who loves satire and like poking fun of stories and poking fun of characters and cliches, like, you've got people who are, in the book, living out cliches and stories and characters that they've almost been forced to do, and some of them are indifferent, like the current mayor, king, or whatever of the town. Some of them are way too into it, and it creates this like funny tension of like the fluidity of like narratives and consistency and reality that, for me, I think grief and comedy are two things that intersect very well in that kind of situation. As for anime, I'm a relatively new weeb. I say that, I don't know how true that is. I've got a relatively new hardcore one. 5 years. And I read a lot of like literary leaning manga, I guess. I don't know. Taiyo Matsumoto is an author I really respect and love. And Urasawa and Otomo. And their ability to create like relatively grounded and wholly realized. And I think for me what's like really interesting is like I'm more interested in voice than anything else in style, and very consistent and distinct. The book is really about stories and myths and the lies we tell ourselves. And, you know, the manga anime one almost runs counter to the medieval fantasy one that the town is lost in. It allows a kind of cartoon logic.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you said that you had the idea for the Agincourt part 5 years ago going to that festival, and then but also you've been into anime for 5 years. So do you feel like they've kind of grown together, or they've been running parallel or something like that?
Look, I'm on the spectrum, and I'm a huge nerd for a lot of things. I absorb a lot of media and a lot of genres, I guess. And as a child, I was a big fantasy nerd. I was a big Tolkien nerd, and I played Warhammer, and I played a lot of CRPGs like Baldur's Gate. They were really like things I haven't really been into since I was about 13, but they are permanently etched in my brain. And same with anime, which I guess I've been watching since I was 6, Cheese TV. And these things, you know, they're not separate from my like love of like kind of difficult literature, which I've been into since I was 10 or whatever. Yeah. So it's all very intermingled. And I think it's that thing of fantasy, I guess, at the end of the day, of unreality. And people, I think now more than ever, have a strong, disturbing desire to live in fiction. And the only character in the book that never really embraces it wholeheartedly is the protagonist, who's fairly indifferent to the whole thing. They run on similar logics. They allow the same kind of bullshit. And if you like making fun of things, boy, do they have all the things that you can make fun of. So leave themselves wide open.
So they were like meant to be. They were always going to be entwined with each other because yeah, they've got that same logic, like you said.
But I mean, I don't want to harp on about it, but I do love the tension of like, I think fantasy, the kind of fantasy and historical stuff I'm making fun of is relatively well known to a certain kind of, you know, normal quote unquote person. Whereas, you know, this country town's fear of the new, and like it is kind of represented by manga and anime, which the book's Aboriginal character, who's like a contemporary artist, is a huge anime and manga nerd. And that's another thing that really others him in a town that has weird but strict traditions. I mean, my favorite chapter in the book is when they have the town council meeting and they can never decide on the vibe or the tone or the consistency and what's allowed, if you can dress up as an elf or whatever.
Yeah, there's like laws that they decide that, you know, oh no, this this is Agincourt and this is not Agincourt kind of thing.
It was very important to me that it was not consistent. That's like a really key part of it, because a big part of it is satirizing Australian self-narratives of myth-making, and I think we're a very inconsistent and kind of hypocritical country, and I love that the town can never decide what the tone or what the vibe is, and nobody really knows. Mm. Some people are terrifyingly hardcore, like the captain, and some people are largely indifferent. So,
and so yeah. Just as a final question for our chat this afternoon, you mentioned before that your previous shortlisted manuscript, which was in the Fogarty Award 2 years ago, and so what does it mean for you to be shortlisted again for the Fogarty Literary Award this year?
Well, how blunt can I be? Look, as a 33-year-old, autistic person who was like living with my parents and was like essentially unemployed, just like the idea of $20,000 makes me salivate, unfortunately. But it has been kind of my dream since I was small to do nothing but write and publish novels. And I think the thing I've been like kind of desperate for and begging for like my whole life is just like permission to be able to do it. So I'm a real once I get my foot in the door kind of guy, they can't get me out. But I have so many more books in me. So I think it's permission, point of a better word, to keep writing them and keep going. Even though I have a very distinct and very weird.
But yet so many more manuscripts in that very distinct and weird style to come.
Yeah, I got about 50 in me, and I think about 5 are good. But I'll write that anyway.
Yeah, that's a good percentage, you know. Oh, that's really great. Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us, and thank you for talking to me today, and all the best for the award ceremony.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I'll be hosting the 2023 Fogarty Literary Award. This is a free event that's taking place at the ECU Spiegelton on Thursday, the 25th of May, 2023. Tickets are available from the Fremantle Press website at www.fremantlepress.com.au. I'm Brooke Tennell, and thank you so much for spending time with us today.